This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, I'm sure you've heard of Athletic Greens from a thousand different other podcasts, but the reason why I think this is the case is because it works. I've been using it for years, and the biggest benefits that I've realized is that it gives me more energy. I feel like I'm getting a full and healthy diet. My poops are better, and I'm sorry to say, but it's true. And so if you're somebody who really wants a healthy diet where they're confident they're getting all their micronutrients, go on and head over to drinkag1.com/Farzad. drinkag1.com/Farzad, where you'll get a free vitamin D plus K2 bottle and 5 free travel packs. Thank you so much to Athletic Greens. And now onto the podcast. Everything's broken. No one's having enough kids. I am constantly tired and I'm so sick of just how everything sucks. I've been thinking about this concept for a while. Tell me, like, help me be more optimistic about this, because I've actually been feeling kind of like depressed about this for a few weeks now. Dude, ever since Clive's been born, I've just been thinking and observing the world. Because, you know, I'm going towards, okay, what's the world going to look like for my son? And how can I make it better? And I'm just looking around like, oh my God, this place is so messed up, bro. Like, it's just like, the more I look, the more I feel like everything's broken. Like, fundamentally, media, government, corporate, greed, services, just everything. Everything to me, you know, there are small pockets of like improvements. There are small pockets of like very well-run organizations. And maybe this is me just being too harsh on civilization, or just being too cynical. Or maybe my standards are just too high, or maybe I'm just dumb. I mean, it could be any sort of like on that spectrum. But that's how I've been feeling. It's like I'm observing the world. And I'm like, okay, am I sure that I'm doing everything I can to ensure Clive has a good future? And I feel like looking around like, boy, like this all feels broken. So here's where I get depressed. Actually, go ahead. I don't know, you're off mute. Did you want to say something?
I was just going to say that this is one of the underappreciated factors about why it's important for societies to encourage having children. Like, we have so many people walking around who just want to live in the moment for themselves, not care about, like, they want to know, how do I make my life better right now? Which usually is attached to, how do I make myself feel better in the moment, in the short term? And it just like completely detached from the long-term implications of decisions or systems or any of these things. And then like, once you have kids, you realize, wait a second, like what happens 100 years from now, I actually care about, because my kid's going to live in that world. It's not just how does this work today, it's how does this work tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. And I think this serves a very evolutionary purpose, that when you have a child, it sense like the blahness, the cynicism, the unimpressed nature of how you feel. Like, that's because now the presence of this child in your life makes you hypersensitive for opportunities to make the world a better place. And so we need more people to be hypersensitive about all the things that are broken and how those things need to be improved. And evolution, and this, I'm just talking about evolutionary biology here. Evolution's solution to this problem is, hey, have some kids. Like, and we live at a time where we want to pretend that this isn't how the world works and has always worked for thousands of years or tens of thousands of years or beyond. Like, I don't know how long you think, you know, human civilization goes back to. It's a long time. This is kind of an unbroken change. If we think that, oh, we're just going to snap our fingers in the course of 30, 40, 50 years of human progress, now we're just going to, whew, don't have to deal with that anymore. Like, you don't understand how humans have the ability to continue to be humans under so many different varieties of conditions.
You are nailed it. You just hit that so hard on the head. And I didn't realize how true that statement was until I had a kid. I didn't realize how, like, in my head, I'm like, well, I'm just living. And like, listen, I'm not saying this is good or bad, but I can tell you very much that before I had a child, you know, it was grind mode for 10 years, right? So this was a few years before I met my wife. It was grind mode for 10 years, achieve financial stability, financial independence, you find a mate, You know, and then once we reach that financial stability, financial independence, then we go into our leisure mode, right? Without children. We're like, wow, it feels so awesome. It feels so good. Even when we were working without children, it feels so good. I felt a lot more, you know, I became more cynical and less trusting of, let's say, the systems around me, that they were performing the way they're supposed to be performing for people, right? But I didn't really have this like overdrive, super focus on, holy shit, everything's kind of fucked. And it's like, you are distracted. I think most people, and I am 1000% would have put myself in that situation. And I think this applies to a lot of people. I was completely oblivious to the fact that there's so much work to do to make civilization better for the future. There's so much opportunity to make things better for not just ourselves, but our future selves and our children and our children's children, so on and so forth. I didn't grasp that concept. It didn't feel so close and near and dear to my heart as it does now. But it also brings a lot of like just, it's just, it, I feel, it feels insurmountable in a sense. Like it's becoming more difficult for me to like be very optimistic about the future, because I look around and see how broken everything is, right? And it, like, I'll give you a perfect example. This is like a microcosm of why I'm like, okay, like we're just destined to just be in shit for the rest of our lives, right? One of the biggest game breakers of our time, right? Somebody we cover very closely in our channel, Elon Musk, right? In my head, I'm like, this guy just changes the game all the time. He picked a side. He picked the side of a clearly broken two-party system. That sucks. And I'm like, okay, we're just fucked. We're in a constant state of fuck. Like it's, I don't know if you watch Succession, there's going to be a curse fueled, rant. So watch out. There is this show Succession. You ever watch Succession?
I've never seen it.
They have this episode called Shit Show at the Fuck Factory. Okay. And it's just the most, it's literally a shit show at the fuck factory. And like, I remember that episode and I'm like, this is what it feels like. This is what the time it's just, but at the same time. Okay. So the my optimistic side is like, okay, well that's opportunity. That those are like that chaos, right? That I was so fueled by before, that I was like so inspired by before, that chaos and the broken nature of the things I was working on. Those are the opportunities that, number one, give me the ability to get in there and carve something out for myself by bringing value to society. And then I get rewarded for that value, right? I get motivated and I get inspired and I get fulfilled from those things. I get exposed to new ideas, new ways of solving things, meeting new people, so on and so forth. So there's a tremendous amount of positives that come from it. But then I look around and I'm like, where are these people? Like it's becoming, I feel like they're there. They're just silent. Like, or they're working in the shadows and I can't see it. And I just get like, I don't know, man. It's just, I'm just ranting. Hans, I'm just on full-on rant, bro.
Dude, I love it. And so
I didn't know how I got here.
We'll zoom out a little bit. I was gonna talk about it. Just say, well, I completely understand the feeling. The feeling, like I said, I'll go back to saying the feeling has utility. Like we need that feeling so that we can be motivated to go fix things. But like, okay. Zoom out, like how much less messed up is stuff today than it was 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago?
Feels like a lot less messed up. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially, you know, okay, go try and live out in the woods by yourself for a week. Experience how hard, like, you know, people think, oh, let's just go back to nature. We'll be these noble savages. Like, no one wants to live like a noble savage. You're free to go out there and try it. No one's doing it. There's a reason.
There's a couple of people doing it on YouTube and they do a really good job making money doing it with ads.
Yeah. Yeah, but like at scale, you know, you can't have a society like that. And, you know, hot showers are kind of nice. A nice house is kind of nice. You know, the internet, not too bad. I kind of like it. And all of these things exist because we descend from literally hundreds of generations of human beings who met that challenge of, holy crap, the world is a harsh place. Everything's messed up all the time. And I just have to fight like hell every day to make tomorrow better, not for me, but for my kids, than today is. And you just, like, sometimes it works, a lot of times it doesn't, but over the long arc of history, it really, really works. Like, we've come a long, long, long way. We still have a long way to go. And obviously, you know, with some of the things that we're looking at, like, this is why I'm very concerned about artificial intelligence and nuclear holocaust and, you know, the cycle of major empires and societies imploding and that not being a pretty sight and all of these types of challenges. But at the same time, like, we have new tools to solve these challenges that we've never had at our disposal before. Maybe we can fix some of this stuff. So yeah, it's, I think there's reason for a lot of hope, but it has to be an agentic motivated hope. It's not, I just hope things get better. I'm not actually going to contribute to being part of the solution. Someone else is going to solve that problem. It's like, no, like, yeah, that's broken. There's hope, but we have to actually do stuff. Otherwise, it's, the hope's not great.
That's so true. And that's like, that's where the individual, and I mean, again, and I'm speaking from experience, right? There is a trillion times more distractions now than we've had ever in history. The age of the internet has brought incredible power to the individual to create agency. Like, I use this example all the time. Like, this doesn't exist without the internet. It just does not exist. The ability for me to have this channel, this network, is, in essence, it generates an income and it makes my already comfortable life way more comfortable than it ever could have been before. That doesn't exist without the internet. But holy shit, the amount of times I've been on X just scrolling and I'm like, what am I doing? Even with a kid, you know, like, I'm exhausted from taking care of Clive. It's like 9:30 at night. I'm like running on 3 hours of sleep and I'm like, oh my God, you know what I'm saying? And then so like, compound that over multiple years and millions, if not billions of people that are being sort of constantly being thrown these distractions to, like, pull them away from making society better all the time, right? But in essence, though, what's weird is that same system creates content like this that is like, hey, listen, the thing that we're all consuming is kind of like fucking us too. You know what I'm saying? Like, the thing that we're consuming is breaking our ability to really pay attention to the times. But the problem is, fixing is painful too. Fixing is painful. And I feel like humans, I feel like it's in our DNA. We are wired to avoid pain and discomfort unless we feel that it's existential. And the one thing that I'm noticing is that because we have so many distractions, it's difficult for us to identify what is actually existential. And sometimes we tag things that are not existential as existential, and then we're not paying attention to existential things that should be existential, but they're either being covered up or they're very hard to find because there's so much noise. This is the times.
There's noise for a couple of reasons. So there's a famous, you know, psychological study where, you know, they take.
Am I yelling, by the way? I'm sorry.
No. Okay. Where they'll take rats and they'll allow them, you know, you push this thing for food. And when you push it, then there's this bell noise that goes off. And so they push it, they get the food, they hear the bell noise. And eventually the food will run out. And the rats that don't hear the bell noise, when the food stops coming, stop pushing the button. But the rats that hear the bell noise, when the food stops coming out, they'll continue to push the button just to hear the bell noise, because their brain got rewired to actually find reward from the bell noise, rather than, like, the bell noise was supposed to be something that signaled that you were on the way to get the food. Like, the food was the thing that was existential. The bell noise is just random. But you rewire around the intermediate thing that doesn't have any intrinsic value of its own. And then those rats would just sit there and mash on that button forever. just because they kept hearing the bell noise. And it's easy to do this kind of by accident as humans. Like, it's easy to get distracted by the thing that you're using as a proxy for what is actually important in your life. But B, psychologists know this, and they work at big companies, and they are on purpose trying to do this to you. And, you know, lots and lots of very, very smart people, sophisticated people, that are trying to exploit this fact about us. And even when they're not trying to do it on purpose, sometimes it happens at scale on accident. And it's a very difficult thing to contend with. I mean, this is a lot of what you look directly at when you watch the movie The Social Dilemma, is like, you know, they weren't asking, how do we screw over the most young girls in the world possible? They're like, how do we get people to stay on our platforms the longest? Oh, yeah. It just so happens that, like, if you try all the experiments in the world about what works, what it converges to is the things that hack our limbic system, you know, the base part of our brain that reacts to things in fight, flight, freeze, very emotional. And like, when you basically put someone in that state, especially as a child, you know, young girls specifically, it ends up being something that's very inward focused and very destructive to their self image, and feeling like they have to compete with other girls, and there's all the bullying that happens. Like, that is something that ends up being a terrible dynamic to experience as an adolescent. And, but, you know, it's not like the people, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was like, how do we create a massive mental health crisis all over the world? He's just like, how do we figure out how to keep people here? And that, you know, the hackableness of our biology, of our psychology, of our human minds is the reason that this is where we land.
And then we're going to offload the optimization of those systems to artificial intelligence. That's where I mean,
well,
so that's the pessimistic side of me coming through, right?
Yes.
And I have more pessimistic stuff to talk about here. So go ahead.
Do you want to? So
it's a therapy session.
This is why it is so important that we end up building artificial intelligence in a way that pushes agency back into the hands of normal, everyday people. That if we live in a world where the only people that have this type of powerful AI are the big companies or the governments, then normal, everyday people are going to be so screwed, because they'll just be able to be hacked 10 ways from Sunday. Versus if we live in a world where even the poorest person on the planet has access to an artificial intelligence system that can help that person defend himself from whatever information attacks they're being subjected to by other powerful entities, then you live in a much more free and equal society than you do in the other realm. And this is something that I kind of had this aha moment realization that is super uncomfortable and super inconvenient and super unpopular in the vast majority of the world. But if individuals do not have the freedom to engage in misinformation and outright disinformation, that's not the world that we live in. This is why free speech is so important, and even free malicious speech. Because the reality of the situation is that the CIA exists, the NSA exists, the KGB exists, all these foreign equivalents of these things. What are these things? These things are organized on purpose, extremely competent misinformation and disinformation machines. So when you advocate for a world where misinformation and disinformation does not exist, that is not a world that is possible. There's
you're
no
already
such
making
world.
Super powerful entities more powerful.
Yes, you're all you're saying is that the only misinformation and disinformation that is allowed in society is the misinformation and disinformation that is owned by the world's most powerful people, and that the world's most disadvantaged people in the world are going to be the defenseless objects of those attacks.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's very uncomfortable to hear for, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me, but that's very counter to a lot of the rhetoric we've been hearing from a certain part of the political spectrum in the United States, let's say, where it's unsafe to allow individuals to voice their opinions freely, which will create situations where some will say things that could be deemed as quote unquote dangerous or could incite, let's say, an outcome that body thinks is bad, right? But that
unsafe
is
for whom?
Exactly unsafe for whom? And how
is
do you
it
know
unsafe
it's unsafe
for the normal yeah. citizen, right. Or is it unsafe for
the system?
The tyrannical bureaucrat who does not want to be called out for being a tyrant.
Do you think Elon buying X is as important as it felt when he did it?
Yes. Potentially more. It's hard to say. Like, I felt like it was really important at the time, so I don't know if I feel like it's more important now than I did then, but it is absolutely tremendously important. And obviously, you know, his acquisition hasn't been something that's perfect. Like, I think that's an impossible goal or standard to hold it to. Like, the fact of the matter is that there's no such thing as perfect free speech. It doesn't exist. And so there's no way to say that, oh, the handling of all speech everywhere at all times by such and such entity is perfect. But I would say, man, this is the most perfect platform for free speech that exists on the internet today, that is not just the internet itself. Like, the internet itself is the most perfect forum for free speech in the world. And Mark Andreessen is potentially one of the most important human beings in the history of humanity.
The GOAT.
Because this dude, while in college, wrote this software that then proliferated around the world and allowed normal everyday people all over the place to have access to one another. Like, the human superorganism, whatever you call us, is a completely different human superorganism once it is fully wired up and fully connected than it is when it is isolated by information exchange that is purely limited to books and radio waves and television broadcasting networks. Like, it's just a different thing. Like, radio, television, and books are all one-way information exchange mediums. There's no conversation that's happening there. And the internet allows two-way communication, not only one-to-many, one-to-one, many-to-one, like all these forms of connection. Like, it's just completely different. And I think that the internet is the moment of the singularity, personally. Like, the singularity is often described as the point after which you can no longer predict what the future is going to look like, because, you know, the information or the space of possibilities gets so big. And, you know, outside of a few autistic people inside of the tech community, like, very few people predicted what the future once the internet began looks like. And that possibility space just keeps continuing to expand. Like, there's no artificial intelligence without the internet. There's no Uber. There's no Airbnb. There's no YouTube. There's no Google. Like, you know, think of all of these things do we have, like, there's no electric cars without the internet. Because without the internet, the fact that you want to be online all the time, like, that's the reason to buy all these electronic devices. The progress that we had in batteries that finally made it possible to make an electric vehicle feasible, because that energy density in batteries had gotten to where they were. Like, we needed tons and tons of electronic devices to make that even a thing that was possible. And those electronic devices don't exist without the internet. So, like,
how crazy is that?
It is one of those turning points in history. It's like, wow, you know, a left turn instead of a right. Because when you go back and listen to Mark Andreessen and what he was talking, so there was going to be some sort of an online network that was going to happen. But what was more likely, that it be open source or closed source? Like, AOL was the dominant form of internet. And, you know, that was not an open browser. Like, they directed your traffic where they wanted it. They put your eyeballs where they got paid for it. And then Netscape comes along and it's like, yeah, you can just go wherever you want. Look at whatever you want. Anyone can come on here and put whatever they want on here. Like, there's no censors. That is just a radically different. Like, that is the AI future that people keep telling you about is so scary. We don't want people to be able to put whatever prompts they want into the system and just get out what they asked for. Like, we can't do that. You know, we don't want people to just be able to go read things on the internet that other people say that are not approved. Like, you can't do that.
Such a good point. Such a brilliant point, huh? Wow. I never really thought about it that way. It's like this dude, history, it's totally a time. It's a flat circle. The amount of times history repeats itself is insane. It's like, you just have to find the proper parallels to, like, analyze the repetition. Because there's definitely, like, I know, like, there's a saying, like, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think it fucking repeats itself. It totally does. It's just in different contexts, you know. But the underlying concepts totally repeat themselves. And you were talking about, one of the things you were talking about with the internet, the thing that keeps coming to my mind as it pertains to that is, one of the sayings I always hear is like, hey, the internet is not real life, right? People are like, hey, internet is not real life. That's not what it's like. That's not what people are like, you know? I have a very counter sort of against the grain thought there, that I think that the internet, like social media, like a place where people can actually express themselves as freely as possible. Let's say, like, let's use X as an example. That's one of the most, if not the most closest place where people can freely express themselves. My argument is that is a much more accurate reflection of humanity than the real world, because people censor themselves a lot in reality, because nobody wants to be offensive, right? I think most people are just, they have a, you know, it's our DNA. It's like, hey, we don't want to, like, disrupt our relationship, because there might be some benefit here from us talking to each other. You know, like, I don't want to create an enemy. It's not good for my survival. Why would I create an enemy? I want to create friendships. I want to reach across the aisle and meet people. You know, some people like to do that more than others. Some people do that, you know, for terrible reasons, right? To, like, really fulfill personal objects that they're trying to do, whatever it may be. Like, but we don't have all the true, like, our day to day, we don't really get exposed to the realness of humanity outside of, like, say, your closest friends or your closest family members, right? But those are very, like, few individuals. It's not at scale. And so that's what I find most fascinating about places like X, is, like, it's really humanity at scale. And when people say this is not real life, I agree, it's not real life. It's a more accurate representation of what humans are actually like. And then you put that within the context of, like, okay, we're trying to create an AI in the future that's trying to be as maximally aligned with humanity. Seems like the perfect fucking data set to do that.
Well, it's interesting. One of the ways, or the analogies that I like to use for it, and obviously, you know, thinking by analogy is not always a great thing, but we're going to do it anyways. Are you more you when you're drunk or when you're sober? Like, different people are going to answer that question in different ways. But I think being on social media is a lot like you being the version of you that exists when you're drunk than when you're sober.
God forbid you're on social media drunk. That's when it really goes. I mean, it's true though, because that's when shit gets off the rails. You know, like I've there's been a couple days in my past where I've been on social media when I shouldn't have been, and boy, was it a. I'm like reading back. I'm like, what the fuck was I? What was that? You know? And it's like, I'm ashamed of it because I said it. And I'm sure at that time, all the filters were down and, you know, everything. But I find that infinitely fascinating about social media and the internet. It's like, it really is. And it really does, you know, it's just been so fascinating that there's been so much fear and control around that, you know? And if I draw a parallel to say a good or bad future with artificial intelligence, I think there's, you know, that's like beginning to really change my mind to be like for the better, because I have this underlying fear or underlying doubt that these systems are really going to be available for the many. And so like the example that I use, like say within the context of even let's use self-driving cars as an example, and then we'll use a human or robot example, right? When self-driving is solved, be it Tesla or whoever, right? Let's just say it's Tesla in this case. Who are the people that are gonna buy those cars? The people that have money or the people that don't have money, right? You need resources to be able to buy those self-driving cars. These self-driving cars are gonna be able to create massive amounts of passive income for those people that own it. But you can't really own it unless you have money. And the ones that have the most money will be able to get the most cars. So you have a multiplier effect on people that already have a lot. AI is going to give them the ability to do even more. And then the human or robots, an even more extreme example, is that who's going to be able to buy the most human or robots? A factory with massive amounts, or a company with massive amounts of cash flow and massive amount of cash on their balance sheet and the ability to raise money? Or me? Who's going to be able to buy the most labor units, right? So that, like, and that's where I'm like, okay, how does that lead to a good future? Help me understand how that leads to a good future, please.
Oh, easy. So imagine that you make $10,000 a year. Like, you are really struggling to get by. How do you get anywhere? Like, you can't afford a car. You can't afford, like, you're walking, riding a bicycle, or you're on public transit of some sort to get anywhere. If you can't get anywhere, how do you do anything productive? Like, what kind of jobs can you have? That's part of the reason you live on $10,000 a year.
Now, but your justification is, so the justification though is that the floor is going to be raised for a lot of those people, but isn't going to be a widening gap.
All of a sudden, you're about to have access to transportation that you can afford, that can get you anywhere that you need to go, any time that you need to go there, for a price that you can afford. Now, your wealth is, like, part of our wealth as humans is being able to go where we want, when we want, because we want. You just now gave access to someone who did not have access before to that good or service. That is a huge win for humanity, in my perspective. And the same thing, you know, like, so if you're talking about someone who was going somewhere on a bicycle or walking, how long does it take to do that? It takes forever. Like, you just gave that person hours and hours and hours every month worth of their time to do something that, whether it's do something productive or just do something that they want. Like, you just made that person richer in the currency that matters, which is their own personal time. And the same thing will be true for the bot, that, you know, just because there may be someone who owns the bot and then they rent it out and someone else uses the bot, the person who's using the bot is going to be using the bot because it can do things for them that save them time or make them money. And so it is a force, as long as, you know, we don't let weird market dynamics completely distort everything overall, that is more, you know, where the whole is more than the sum of its parts. It's like, the fact that someone makes money over here doesn't detract from the fact that you're growing the overall pie so much. And this is the mechanism that we're talking about by which you're growing the overall pie. It's like, yeah, the fact that they just made money doesn't keep the person who's using that service from also making money. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 1 = 4. And each person who's bringing that one to the table or getting their one back from the table, whatever you want to look at it as, you know, at the end of the day, there's more stuff that gets made. And the more stuff that gets made, then the more richer the same exact group of people are in terms of stuff that's available for them to consume.
But doesn't that mean that the ability to provide those services and products become more and more centralized around fewer and fewer entities over time? Because they're going to be the ones that are going to be gobbling up all those resources. Unless there is a race to the bottom of creating those manufacturers. I mean, that's where like the flywheel effect could kick in, right? Where
if you have free markets where it's like, okay, Mr. Service Provider, like whether it's Tesla, the manufacturer of the bots and the robotaxis, like, you know, Tesla's not going to be the only ones that make bots and robotaxis. So if they're making too much money, someone will come in and they'll compete that away. I mean, man, did you see the Unitree humanoid robot demo video that's been circulating around on X?
No.
Like, you should watch it. Dude, that thing is friggin' nuts. Like, really? Okay. China's going to be in the definitely right neck and neck with us on the development of humanoid robots. And
Shocker.
Partially because they have to, but partially just because, like, it's time for that technology to exist. And so, yeah, it only centralizes if artificial barriers are stood up to prevent other people from coming in and trying to compete against you. I mean, there are kind of natural monopolies, network effects, but even those things only last so long. Like, it's almost hilarious. You know, Google's had a monopoly in search for how long now? We're only now starting to be like, you know what? That monopoly in search, that's a problem. Is it coincidental that that just happens to be the case right when artificial intelligence is going to completely disrupt the way that search works and a new winner is going to emerge? Like, that's weird to me. Huh?
So why do you think it's taken so long? Like, walk me through exactly why you think that's weird.
I don't, like, you know, there's conspiracy theory ends of the question, but, you know, first of all, man, Google search is an amazing product. Like, there's a reason we all use Google search. It's because it provides the best freaking search results. And like, they kind of deserve to be able to monetize this product. You know, it's like, they don't make money on the actual search. They make money on the attention of the people that are doing the searching by helping them find things that they want and, you know, participating as a third party in that discovery process. So like, I get that. I think the reason that we finally attack them is because, oh, there's light on the horizon that we're not actually going to need them anymore. It's like, oh, you've been the only person that's been able to provide, like, when I actually need the service and it's actually good, like when it is the best service available, I'm not going to tear that thing down because I need it. Now, like, oh, I don't need it anymore. Oh, you've been a terrible monopoly for these last 20 years. We got to break you up.
I mean, I could put my tinfoil hat on for that. I mean, but it kind of makes sense. It does seem like go ahead.
Think about, like, there have been people that have been saying Google's monopoly in search and attacking them this entire time. Like, the calls for attacking Google's monopoly on search are not new calls. It's just like, for whatever reason, it's only now that whatever, there's something in the dynamics that allows those same things that have been said for 20 years now to actually have influence in the halls of courts.
Power. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. I do find the timing odd, but it also feels like Google's time, like, you know, I would consider Google very much a legacy company for sure nowadays, like a legacy tech company. I mean, a gigantic percentage of their income is ad based, and I don't really see that going anywhere for the time being, you know, unless you have other media companies or other apps or places where people's eyeballs are going to. You know, I'm curious to see how X is going to evolve with this. I think X's ability to become a wallet for people that offers the best rates and the best fees and the easiest, most frictionless way to move money around, financial services, etc. Like, you know, everybody needs money to survive. And if you have an app that everybody could use, and then you also attach this dopamine freaking slot machine with the news feed and the For You feed or whatever, then you have a pretty good formula to keep people on your app for a really long time. So maybe that long term could become a, you know, you have an advertiser boycott now in a lot of ways, but I just don't think that's going to last very long. It's when there's money to be made, the people's moralities seem to shift very quickly, what they deem to be important, you know?
Yeah. And that's, you know, once X is independent of, you know, being like right now, the advertisers are trying to play the power game with X because they have power. Like they are the main, like you, your interests are not allowed to diverge from your main customer. Like that's kind of how that works. So it's like
they can sort of like
how to. Oh yeah, 100%. They can
force Elon's hand. Yeah, they can force Elon's hand to. They think they can. Yeah, they think it can. It's like, hey, listen, we're not going to advertise with you. We're going to put pressure on you. You're going to give us favorable terms here. You're going to do what we say, and then that's when we'll start giving you money, because we know if we withhold our money against you, you're just going to do what we tell you to do. And Elon literally said, "Go fuck yourself." Literally said, "Go fuck yourself," because I have financial services coming, and once that's on board and way more people download my app and use it, you're going to come crying back, because my platform is going to have a giant amount of eyeballs and you're missing out on profit. So fuck you.
And you know, he's one of those rare entrepreneurs who knows how to build a workable business model kind of after the fact. Like, you know, how long is SpaceX a company before you finally get Starlink up and running? It's like can manage funding his runway long enough to invent, or, you know, whatever, like just pull this magic business model out of a hat right when all of the things align. And so it's like, yeah, like when X no longer is dependent on advertiser revenue in any way, shape, or form to operate, like when that's 10, 15, 20, 30, 40% of overall revenues, then not only, like right now he's telling them to GFY, and then like trying to repair is like, well, not you specific advertiser, like this specific advertiser over here, and like trying to repair relationships. Like this is Linda's ridiculously hard job right now.
Shout out Linda.
But at some point that flips, and no long, like there's no going to anyone with hat in hand. It's like, we've got the eyeballs and we have the technology to serve great ads, you know, to people right where they need it. I mean, this is somewhere that Google still has X beat. If they even want to continue to offer advertisements. Like, I think this ecosystem can be completely self-funding without advertising whatsoever. And there's a very possible future in which you're just like, you know what? The ads actually detract from the overall user experience. We don't need it. It's insignificant. And I just don't care. And the thing is able to make tons of money and be an incredible product and service without any of that whatsoever. And so then it's just like a non thing. But even if they do decide to continue offer advertising on the platform, the advertisers get zero say, because their dollars are, you know, pennies compared to whatever the other income streams are. And so the other income streams are the things that dictate what the product is and what gets shown and what doesn't and where and when and why and how and who.
Yeah. I mean, it would be amazing if X can somehow create a post advertising world where a creator on the platform or whatever, a service or a product provider on the platform is able to generate a an income that matches or exceeds that of, say, a YouTube without the need of advertising on the platform. That would be fucking amazing. And it would just do everything.
Yeah. I can tell you the two big fat honeypots that exist right now that, to me, are the no-brainers. It is the App Store honeypot. Like, in a competitive marketplace, Apple doesn't just get to say, hey, everyone who makes things that people use on the internet, pay me 30% anytime a person who uses your device. Like, you know, your gross margin is my opportunity. That's a thing that has the potential to go away in the future. Obviously, Google's advertising thing, that's one of them that, you know, we're talking about that. But in the context of a no advertising future, there's content creation, like there's a lot.
Yeah.
I guess it really is the one, like the Apple one is a huge one. And figuring out how to monetize search maybe in a different, like if you can disrupt, or you know, XAI has the ability to participate in whatever this search disruption is that's going to kind of attack Google's core product. And so if you can replace that search with semantic search and you can do it well, then, you know, I don't know what the different forms of monetization are, but you can disrupt Google search and substitute it with a different form of monetization potentially.
That's where Grok is very interesting, right? Because Grok on X is kind of this thing
that's specifically why X, you know, owns a large portion of XAI.
Yeah, exactly. And like the revenue model or the business model could be obviously, so if you want to use Grok, you have to pay. It's X premium. You have to pay, I think, $26 a month or whatever that dollar figure is, $20 a month, or maybe less. Maybe $6 a month. I think $6 a month gets you Grok.
I think
the number
was eight, if you do online.
Online, on web. 11 on the App Store, I believe. And so if that's the case, then maybe the searches that are provided or the results that are provided based on your search or your query, those can't be divvied up between the creators that created the data set for Grok to be able to generate the result. And then that's how the payouts are made. It's based on like, whose data am I using to come up with the result? And then those people get paid based on those queries, you know? And then there's also a fee on the compute somehow that gets figured out. And then X's goal is to, that's basically the business model. And then X's goal is to make the querying and the generation of the result as efficient as possible from an energy perspective and a compute perspective. And then the more they can do that, the more they pocket profit, right? And that becomes a way of, that's the next generation business model for search in a post-ad world. But I just don't see advertising going away. I don't see it going away, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some, like, I don't think the world is going to go post-advertising, but you might be able to have a post-advertising platform or two.
A lot of people will enjoy that. But there's also a lot of people that don't want to pay. There's a lot of people that are like, they can't afford to pay. You know? Mm-hmm. I think if everybody could afford to pay for YouTube Premium, they would. You know? Because it really is it's a fucking life-changing. If you're watching this, you don't have YouTube Premium and you can afford it, I highly recommend you do so. Truly. I highly recommend you do so because it really is a huge change, positive change in consuming content. But it's only valuable because we live in an advertising world where ads dominate our lives. And anything that's free, yeah.
I mean, think about it this way. Even if you only make $7 an hour, it costs, what, $20? So 3 hours worth of work gets you YouTube Premium.
Like your $28.
No, 20. Okay, so four hours. Simple question. In a month, do you watch more than 4 hours or listen to more than 4 hours worth of ads?
Probably.
Simple as that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do, especially on TV. If we can get blasted with shit all the time, radio. so on and so forth. Dang. Nice.
Yeah, I mean, if you make $20 an hour, it's an hour and a half.
Yeah, quick.
And yeah, so like, do you end up consuming more than an hour and a half worth of ads on YouTube over the course of a month?
Yeah, but those lattes probably at Starbucks, bro. Especially when they misspell your name.
It's worth your time. Like, you'll save.
Definitely.
You'll save.
Coming from a couple people that generate an income from advertising, get the non-ad option. It's better. Yeah.
Well, I mean, definitely better for me. I listen to probably hundreds of hours of YouTube in a month. Mm-hmm. So like the amount of advertising I would be subjected to if I didn't have YouTube Premium on the amount of YouTube that I listen to would be insane.
Yeah. Same. Okay. I think I'm good because I can feel myself starting to fade today a little bit. I had horrendous sleep last night. I don't know if you saw my middle of the night Discord message from the morning, but it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was responding to David. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clivey's.
I didn't realize what time it was. And I saw David like, Clive. And I was like, oh, that's because it was, late. Yeah.
Just bad. Yeah. I mean, he's like, sort of like.
And those regressions
oscillating.
Are. Yes. So it's sleep gets better. You're like, hey, I'm a human again. This is the best sleep in the world. And then there's a regression. You go back to not sleeping. I'm like, oh my God, how did I survive this? Motherfucker.
Yeah, that's my life right now. I mean, it's way better than it was when he was a newborn. I mean, he turns 3 months already. What the fuck? He turns 3 months already on the 29th. So I just can't believe it, but he does. And the first 4 to 6 weeks were probably the most challenging thing I've ever had to do. That was absolutely insane. Yeah. So even now it's like, okay, it's not terrible. It sucks. It's painful. You know, I had to force myself to the gym this morning, but you know, and I'm fading, bro. I am fading right now. But yeah,
this is where the allergic response to responsibility makes me hilarious. Like, we can't trust you to be responsible with the content you consume or the things that you say online, but we'll give you a baby, just take it home.
How crazy is that? Yeah, right.
You'll be fine.
What the fuck is that? What is that? We can't trust you with the words you say, but we can trust you with the most like sensitive, most precious, most vulnerable thing of all time.
Yep.
And then, both things are yours.
First time parents, like, you have no fucking idea what you just got yourself into. You have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah, no
idea.
You
have no idea how to keep this baby alive, but you'll figure it out. It's going to be fine.
Bro, my brother, I was talking to my brother yesterday. He told me this thing. He's like, bro, you don't have like a full-time job. You do your own thing. Like, and I know you have a baby, but I can't, like, I don't understand how you say like you don't have time for stuff. I'm like, how do I describe this to you? How do I describe this to you?
It's the same thing that, you know, our parents told us when we were kids, like, you're not going to understand until you have kids.
Yeah,
like,
until you do.
You have to actually do it.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise, shut the fuck up. Like, you just don't know.
Yeah. You have to live in it. It's when you're sleep deprived and you can't go more than, if you're lucky, unless you have a partner that's incredible and is like constantly covering for you, you know, like an hour or so at a time of like focus. And then when you start that focus period, you're already exhausted. You got to flow yourself into the focus. And by the time you get yourself into the flow, you get disrupted. And then you got to re-engage again. Your brain's already exhausted from refocusing. And now you have to do it again and again. And then the next night you get the same shitty sleep. And so you feel even worse. And then you got to do that again. Then it's like, it's brutal. And it goes back to our original conversation. It's like, that pain is what is making me so inspired in a way, but also so aware of the shit that I wasn't aware of before. Because I'm going through all of this and I'm seeing the incredible changes that's going through through him and with him. And I'm like, man, I want everything to be awesome for this kid. Because I'm busting my fucking ass for him. Even this early on, I'm only in it for 3 months, y'all, and I'm already fucking bitching, yep, whining about it. But it's like, I can't help but think that way. And so like, and that's impossible to instill unless you go through it. I don't care how, if you're the most ambitious entrepreneur of all time and the most ambitious person of all time and the most brilliant person of all time, you haven't unlocked most of your true potential until you have children. You just haven't.
That pain in general is a huge forcing function for maturing. It's, yeah, you know, kind of binary. It either wipes you out. You know, it's one of those things. If it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Like some people, it does. It wipes some people, parenthood wipes them out. Like,
yeah,
they just can't do it. And it is like, you know, society says, hey, here, take this baby home. And then they can't, they legit can't. Yeah. But if you are not and I would say that's the minority of people. If you're not in that small camp of people that it legitimately wipes out, man, pain is a forcing function for maturity. And parental pain specifically is a very intrinsic, like every single person in your family lineage from you back to the beginning of when humans were humans went through that process.
Yeah. And they faced some brutal moments a lot of us don't face anymore.
Yeah. Way harder than we have ever experienced.
Fucking lion just snatches your kid up and bye-bye. That's it.
Yep. Or, you know, I mean, lions disease are scary, but, you know, what's more scary is the fact that we didn't have plumbing, you know, no indoor plumbing. Yeah. So everyone is drinking out of pee-infested, poop-infested water all the time for all of human history.
Yeah.
Brutal. And like all the stuff that goes along with that. So yeah, like, you know, sidebar, shout out to plumbers. Cause it's really nice not to live in a world full of cholera and typhoid and literal shit.
If you're a plumber, you want to sponsor us, please send me a DM on X at Farziness or send a DM to Hans C. Nelson on X or send me an email. You can find it on the about page for this channel. Like it's so true. Like so many things we take for, and then thank you for like, that's where I get optimistic because it's easy to lose sight of just the amount of incredible stuff that we have. Not like, forget about me personally, like how I've been fortunate to land where I'm at, but like as a civilization, like, and it's impossible to understand that unless you research history a little bit and look in the past and realize what the past was like so that you can learn that the future, that the present is incredible. And that we're very much on a steady trajectory to the betterment of society. We'll have bumps, you know, these like little bumps are like civilizations collapsing. You know, like the one thing I always think about is like, oh my God, the Roman Empire collapsed. And this sounds like an incredibly horrific thing, which of course I'm sure it was for the Romans, but then you're like, oh yeah, but we're here. Like the population is what, a couple orders of magnitude larger than when the Romans were around, something like that. Maybe at least one, no, a couple. Must have been a couple orders of magnitude at least. And, you know, we have the internet, you know, and seems like a pretty peaceful time. And we have plumbing. I mean, I guess the Romans had plumbing too, right? They must have had plumbing.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, so a very functional for their point in time version of plumbing.
Yeah. So the Romans collapsed, but it seems like humans figured it out. So humans will always figure it out. It's just the path to the ultimate state of what humanity is supposed to be is rife with discomfort and pain and feeling like everything sucks, because it does for the time. But when you look back in time, it's 1,000 times better, right? And like, again, full circle. The more people feel like that, the better society gets, which is kind of oxymoronic, but it's true. I feel like, well, the more people feel like that and they feel and they have a forcing function to make change, will improve the present and the future. So the forcing function the dynamic has to exist.
Underneath the saying, hard times make strong men. Strong men make good times. Good times make weak men. Weak men make hard times. And it just repeats itself. That, you know, that is that pain, that motivation, that like acceptance. It's really just an acceptance of responsibility and an appreciation for the fact that we can make things different than they are. And not only we're going to. The question is, you know, if we're in the cycle where it's good times made us and now we're weak people, we're going to make changes and those changes aren't going to be good. They're going to be changes that bring about more hard times. And, but on the flip side, hey, if we recognize we can make changes for the better and we allow hard things either from our own time or just being historically literate enough to understand how these hard time cycles have played out in the past, we'd be like, oh, let's learn from their hard time mistakes to be strong people today instead of having to live through that. I mean, you don't have to look back very far. World War One and World War Two were a century and some change ago. So like we've got pretty hard times in very recent memory that we can make sure that we use as context for what we do. And we can absolutely create a world that is far better than the one that we have grown up with to this point. And if we don't accept that responsibility and actually create that world, not just like happen into it, if we don't create that world, then it will not be that world. It will be a different world, which will not be a good one.
So whether you think we're on the cycle right now, today?
So I personally believe that one of the things that the internet allows for, I don't think Elon Musk is able to achieve 100 different incredible things in his one lifetime in a pre-internet world. Like, I think there were people that were that friggin' smart, that friggin' driven, that friggin' accomplished, or capable.
They couldn't leverage.
But yeah, the leverage didn't exist. It just wasn't something that was available. And I think we have enough insanely incredible people like that who are then able to surround themselves with other insanely motivated people that we are creating that abundant future over the long arc. My question is the short to medium term, that we may create the technological solutions that allow for an incredible future at the same time that we make a whole host of political decisions that bring about the end of the American experiment, which I think would take a long time for the world as a whole to recover from. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we're kind of on the verge of, if the West does not develop technology on a fundamental philosophy that and this goes back to the conversation we've been having, like every human being on the planet needs to have access to the most powerful technology in the world and freedom of thought, freedom of action, freedom of responsibility, freedom of opportunity, freedom of speech. If all humans, like if that is not the underlying philosophy on which the future of artificial intelligence is built, that's really, really scary to me.
Yeah.
And that's definitely not the philosophy on which the Chinese are building their version of the artificial intelligence future. And it's not the version of the future that a lot of companies in Silicon Valley are trying to build that future. That was the underlying philosophy that Mark Andreessen had when he created Netscape.
Yeah.
And we need the technological successor to the internet And, you know, one of the other things that we have talked about, and so this is one of the areas where I do have hope that we'll get the first philosophy, is A, you know, I think that Elon is much more aligned with that philosophy. So there's at least one proof case that someone is trying to do that. There's more besides, but there's one that the audience will be familiar with. The other thing is, you know, we've talked about there's only two ways to make money in the world: bundling and unbundling. The initial explosion of the internet was a wave of unbundling, things that had been bundled previously. And then Web 2.0 is the rebundling phase. Web 3.0 was supposed to be the unbundling phase. You know, that's your crypto technology. I think that there's a lot of crypto technology that is very philosophically aligned with this, and that philosophically provides the foundation for some of these things. Those technologies kind of have to be made to work alongside of artificial intelligence. So if you can have a Web 3.0 plus AI future, then that is one of those. This is the unbundling cycle again. And that unbundled cycle, I think, is the one where freedom and personal empowerment is back on the rise.
Yeah. So you're optimistic about the near term. So you think we're in weak times creates strong men, and strong men are starting to create the good times through those technologies.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I would say that.
I think I agree.
I think that, you know, one of the things about living in a globalized society is that, man, there's always hard times somewhere. Like, you can import strong men from a place where they've endured hard times. Like, that is the legit definition of what Elon, like, growing up in South Africa as a Gen Xer, that was hard times. That was not easy time. You know, he didn't grow up in, you know, the suburbs of...
Dude, immigrants, period. All immigrants.
Period. Yeah.
Yeah, immigrants, period. Well. All immigrants are, I mean, almost all immigrants, let's
say, have been subjected to hard times.
Yeah, and that's why they immigrated. So that's why the United States is so fucking awesome, because you're importing the pain. You're importing pain. And that pain is what creates...
the character that is born out of pain.
Correct. And that is so uniquely profound about this. And that's why, even though I'm like, this conversation has done a lot to lift me up, so thank you for that. Is that I should give you like a fee for like a therapy session. That is ultimately what has me feeling like, that's what gives me, when I think about that again and again and again, I'm like, yeah, but the formula is there for us to be completely fine. We just have to, this is where the control, like, we have to make sure there's no control, so that there's no unreasonable regulation of these individuals to ensure that they're maximizing their experiences to generate good times for people. Right. And so the challenge becomes, how long can we make that good time phase last? You know, because I think, you know, if we're gonna admit and accept that this is a cycle that will continue, then at the very least, what we need to do is ensure that the good times last forever. And we always feel like it's a bad time, but it's actually a good time. Right. So that's our ultimate goal as a species, is to, like, I think, achieve that. But that's so hard to do. Because wine tastes amazing, okay? Video games are very fun. Social media is addicting. Traveling is awesome, right? Just hanging out and partying is the best, you know? But if you have kids, you'll get grounded every single moment of your life. Because you look at that little kid, you'd be like, God, this child is the best. And then you look outside, you're like, holy fuck, why didn't they paint those lines on the road? This is dangerous. And then, so, dude, it's so true, man. It's like, I did not appreciate just how foundational children are. Like, we keep coming back to this thing. It's such a foundational piece of our civilization. If we stop having kids, we're fucked in so many different ways. It's unbelievable. Forget it.
Yep.
Like, forget the population collapsing. The will of the people, like the light of humanity's will to make society better, that light dims, is gone.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Fuck. But now you made me pessimistic again because, you know, fucking birth rates are down. I'm on this roller coaster, Hans. What's going on? Get me out of
the birth rates
this
are down.
Yeah.
Some places, they're not down everywhere. You know,
it's true.
You go. It's crazy that the place where life is the hardest is where people have the most kids.
No, oh, well.
And yeah, I mean, it's absolutely insane when you think about it. Like,
but it backs it up. That backs up our notion. Because they're looking around, right? They're looking around. They're like, I need to make the world a better place for my children constantly. I need to make the world a better place for my children. And I feel like I'm adding to society. I'm making the world better for my children. And so they have more children. You know what I'm saying? Because they feel like they're actually doing something active to ensure that they're creating the proper place and the proper like environment for them to have more kids. That's the way I view it.
Well, there's also a huge element of, I need help. Let's have some more kids so they, like, you know.
Bear, put them to work.
Kids that grow up in that environment, you know, they are contributing to the functioning of the family unit as children. They're not, you know, that's one of the reasons why in the West, it feels like children are a burden instead of a blessing, is because, you know, it's harder to go to work when you got kids at home and, you know, all these things.
So true.
Whereas, you know, when you live in an agricultural society, like, hey, we got a bunch more land that we need to take care of. I need some more hands to help me out. Like, let's make some babies.
Put Timmy on the hoe.
Yeah. In more ways than one.
Yeah. Oh man. Wow. This was awesome. This was great.
We've been needing to have the parenting conversation for a while. So yeah.
We're just scratching the surface, I feel like. There's so much there.
Yep.
I think the aha moment for me around the birth rate was really, it's not just a numbers thing. It's really not just a numbers thing. It's a light of consciousness thing. It's like it's a will to make society better thing. It's just not that simple. And like, you know, like a lot of times we see it driven as like a number thing. Oh, there's people having less kids, so people need to have more kids, right? So that we just have more kids. But like it's the context is not understood why. Like society, I think at large, perhaps we don't talk about it maybe in the Western world, or like you said, like we've made having children more of a burden than something that adds to your life and adds to, like, if you are a human being and you don't have children, or at the very least you don't care for children, right? Like, let's say you're not capable of having children, but you want to be a parent and you want to take care of children, you're missing out on like 80% of what it means to be a human being. You know, like there's so many emotions and so many thoughts and ideas and feelings that you get from interacting with a child that you just can't get anywhere else. And how you share those feelings with your partner and how you feel about your partner within that context, and watching your partner work as hard as they can to ensure that this living thing is alive and can thrive. And then that living thing smiles at you and it's like, hey, thanks for making me laugh or whatever, you know? It's like, it's hard to convey. It's like, it's hard to sell that in the world again with all the distractions that we have, you know?
Yeah.
Very hard.
Well, I mean, this is one of the tough cycles when it comes to progressive societies, is that you get to a point where you face the tension between two things, which are both true.
Yeah.
And when the pendulum swings from one thing to another, this is, I think, one of the major struggles that we're at in Western society. So those two things are, there are dynamics which are beneficial to society as a whole. And the society as a whole has a vested interest in preserving these dynamics. These dynamics are centered around having children not only the motivation to have them, but then the environment in which to have them. It is clear, unobjectively, obviously true that the best environment for two children or for a child to grow up in is with two parents, a man and a woman. Yeah. This is just objectively the case.
Yeah.
And for that man and that woman to both be emotionally stable, healthy people and to provide a good, healthy environment for their children to grow up in. So that is something that's true. It's also true that not everyone can do that. Not everyone should do that. And there is a lot of benefit that is also brought. So that's kind of like the core of what helps a society to be stable long-term is those family values. And, I think understanding of the way to show up in the world as men or as women, like having, for a child to grow up in a house where they can see, okay, this is what being a man looks like. This is what being a woman looks like. And this is what a healthy relationship looks like. And this is what I should try to recreate when I become an adult. there's just like, that has to be the core. Any society that does not succeed at doing that at its core is on the way out.
Yeah.
But it's also true that, not everyone can live the same type of lifestyle. There's a lot like fresh new ideas don't come from this very rigid set of ideals and principles and society. And so, you need crazy people. You need people who are willing to think different, be different, the rebels. And so there's like this tension between, hey, we need to have traditional values and we need to have this rebellious spirit. And those two things need to be in opposition to one another in a way that is actually better for the whole. And you get to a point where it's like, okay, hey, if the society is so dominated by the traditional family values that it squashes the outside perspectives, the non-standard views, the non-standard ways of showing up in the world, whether that's expressed through sexuality or just, people who act different, don't conform to social norms. There's a gajillion different ways this can be seen. Like you get to a point where you're like, hey, actually we recognize that all these other perspectives, they have a lot of value that they can provide to society. And so then the pendulum swings, but then it gets so far over in the, we just, whatever we want to go goes, and then you lose the core of having the fact that probably the right thing for 80% of people to do is to get married in a heterosexual marriage and have kids. Like for the vast majority of people, it's not all people, but the vast majority of people, that's the way to live the most fulfilled, meaningful, productive, positive for society and the greater world life.
Yeah.
But then there's a whole, that still leaves 20% of the people that's not going to be the case for. And it's navigating back and forth between those tensions that's really hard. Like we have definitely said, hey, we really care about what life feels like, is like, acts like for these 20% of people, much more than the 80% of people, because we're good people. Like we want them to have a life that doesn't feel soul crushing.
Yeah.
And that's very legitimate.
But what we've had is we've had an artificial bias against or for one side. And that's why it's like through mainstream media. That's been one of the weaknesses in the West, is that the full spectrum of what society deems as good for society, a part of it has been artificially suppressed. Number one, and then the other side has been artificially boosted. in a lot of ways. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, those sides. I'm just saying that is the dynamic. And yeah, that's not how you create a healthy society long term. And this is not, I'm not saying gay marriage is bad as an example. I'm just saying, like, but the traditional values have been suppressed for sure. Like, yeah, one, like, they have been demonized. They've been demonized.
And I'll just say again that this has been a pendulum that, you know, if you go back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, the media portrayal, like, you know, think about how crazy the 60s were, but then go watch what was on media at that point in time. And that was not reflective of what real life was like. Yeah. It was also artificially suppressed and artificially manufactured. So, you know, in both cases, we have these forces of distortion in what the narrative, you know, the general narrative is or should be. So I don't know. Like, I think that the more that individuals can actually say and create, you know, create content, put their message, whatever their message is for the world, the more that they can say that message authentically and get it out in front of people, then that's when you get a distribution of ideas that really reflects that reality. That, you know, it, when you, that is the thing that removes that artificial boosting or de-boosting. It's like, you know, someone who has one view, like if there's 10 people with one view and 90 people with the other view, and all of them can say their view at the same time, then you get an accurate understanding of what is the distribution of views.
Yep. And then what the more challenging thing, though, as I think about, like, how can that be maximized, where the maximum number of people that are capable of doing that, that have a valuable thing to share, whatever that means, how can we maximize the packaging of that information so that it's actually absorbable? Like, if I'm thinking about it from like a, almost like a business perspective, right? Like, are there services or even artificial intelligence out there that, you know, that I've been dreaming about this for so long, Hans. I would love to just either dump my brain, my ideas, or like just talk into a microphone for an hour, right? Just kind of brain dump. And I have an artificial intelligence that just fucking optimizes that video for me. It creates a fantastic intro. It makes the body of the thing super good. It rehooks stuff. It just can make it super, super digestible by the audience, right? And then it also gives me a fucking banger ass title that is not clickbait.
Legit bait.
We've been doing a lot of legit bait that's been called clickbait because there's all caps, bro. But I stand by that, goddammit. A banger ass title, a banger ass thumbnail that perfectly captures what is being talked about, and it maximizes the exposure of that content. Why don't we have that now? If you're somebody who's working on artificial intelligence and you can create that product where I can just talk into it for an hour and it distills it to 15, 20 minutes and it makes it into a perfect video. It uses my voice. It fucking grabs the B-roll necessary. It does all the editing. It does all the transitions. It just does everything perfectly. Whatever that means. And then it just crafts a perfect title and thumbnail. You will be a billionaire overnight. Guaranteed. And you will open up the doors to so many content creators. It's crazy. So if you're listening to this, please, 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 I'm going to clip this out and put it on X, bro. This is a call. Please build this. Somebody please build this. We have the technology. We can do it. 11 Labs exists. Okay. Even if you just take what I say and just there's, I guess there's got to be a way to do it. Somebody's doing it. That is content. Bro, Grok should be able to do that. If you're going to have most of the compute for any like AI company out there and you want to specialize in media, talk about a differentiator. Make that part of Grok. Be like, hey, content creators, you just talk into a mic for an hour, whatever. Just talk into a thing and then we'll just make the perfect piece of content based on what you say. But it's yours. It's 100% yours. It's just maximally absorbable by the audience.
Yeah, that's that's a huge inference market right there.
Run it on fucking Teslas. I don't give a fuck. Figure it out. I'll pay whatever you want. Okay.
Well, this one's going to be interesting to edit.
Yeah, right? Do you want to do it or should I do it? I have some bandwidth today. I don't mind doing it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you have bandwidth.
I don't know if I have bandwidth for the rest of the day today, actually.
I'll do it. I'll take care of it.
Okay.
I put aside about an hour or so. Hour and a half. It usually takes two. I tell myself, this is going to take an hour to edit. It's two, y'all.
Yeah.
It's 2 hours to edit. But when it's only two of us, it takes less time because I don't have to do as many cuts between the
it depends on
the frames.
How often we go back and forth.
We went back and forth a lot on this one.
Yeah.
I should just let you talk the whole time. Oh, and by the way, if somebody can make an AI that can make these podcasts easier, there's such a huge market here for content creation. It's crazy. It hurts my brain.
I sucked at figuring out how to use it, and it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But yeah, the little SnapPod thing that I downloaded last week, it did help with making cuts from person to person. Yeah, in DaVinci.
Okay.
So
I'm sure, I don't know why Premiere, I don't know why I haven't spent time looking into this.
I'll bet you there's something from Premiere Pro.
I'm sure.
I would bet. In fact, I know there is. I remember thinking, man, I wish they had that on DaVinci Resolve. They have it on Premiere Pro.
So it literally just auto cuts the feeds. Like as soon as the audio kicks in, it just puts the feed as a primary feed on the screen. Yep. Okay, I'm doing that the second I get off here. I need to figure this out.
Yeah, the one that I do, like it will, it just creates a new video track on top and it cuts and brings up to the top whoever is speaking. So it's not even like messing up your underlying tracks.
Okay, like it's just a layer on top of the other two that you have.
Yep.
Okay, whatever it does, I don't care how it does it. That probably makes more sense because then it won't disrupt your other. Yeah, that makes more sense because then it retains your original feeds. Yeah. Okay.
So what's the banger intro for this weird conversation?
Fuck you. I'm kidding. I think it's in there. I think it's in there somewhere.
Everything everywhere is fucked all the time. And it always has been. And it always will be.
Everything's broken. No one's having enough kids. I am constantly tired. And I'm so sick of just how everything sucks.
I never realized how much everything sucks until right now. And it is freaking depressing.
I'm speechless. That might be the intro right there. That's perfect. Should we do another fuck it? Let's go with
it. I'm so depressed. I'm so depressed. I'm speechless.
I'm so depressed. I'm speechless. I mean, that's a fantastic title. And it literally...
Becoming a parent made me so depressed, I'm speechless.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to end recording now. You're welcome, everybody. Enjoy today's episode of Hans and Farzad Talk Shit.
Oh, my God.
All right. Here we go. And this seems like it's a complete reversal.
Did you watch the All In podcast this last?
Oh, shit. What just happened?
Something's running out of battery, so I assume something's not plugged in, right?
No. My dumbass accidentally turned off. Hold on. Alexa, turn off studio.
Okay.
Alexa, turn on studio.
Okay.
Alexa, turn on studio.
Okay.
There we go. Sorry. Where'd you go?
I'm here.
Oh. Okay. Whoa. Sorry. What was that? What was your question? Did I?